submersible diving is a very personal experience. Being there, seeing it with your own eyes, feel the connection with the animals is sometimes a life-changing experience to some people.
Under the ocean, I believe that there is so much to be discovered.
And hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Yacht Crew Logs right here on Yachting International Radio. My name is Ria. I am your host, and I'm very pleased to welcome my next guest. He is Ofer Keter, the president of Submerge. He is an explorer, a sub pilot, a diving instructor, certified tour guide, photographer and videographer, and as well, the co-founder of an experiential travel company called Origin Escapes. So you have quite the resume, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Ria.
Let's talk about you first. Now, tell me about you as a kid. Who are you? Where are you from? And bring us in a brief overview up till today.
Sure. Fantastic. So I was born in Israel. My family is originally from Israel, many generations. And then as a very young child, baby, my parents decided to immigrate to the U.S. So I had a U.S. childhood in Chicago, which was very different from where my parents and my grandparents grew up. And then later on in life, my parents decided to move back to Israel, to the region, the Northern Galilee, the northern part of Israel, where our family is originally from. And I grew up there from middle school through high school. And then as most 18-year-old Israeli kids, young adults do mandatory military service. So I joined the military in Israel at 18. Went through the different training processes and then joined the officers academy. So I became an officer in the military, which extended my mandatory service, and I ended up serving for 4 years. And at that stage, I made a life decision between, do I keep on in the military as a career, or do I go and find my own path? And that's what I chose. And when I was growing up, I was very fond of the Mediterranean. So I spent a lot of time in the ocean, in the Mediterranean, freediving, snorkeling and swimming, and became a scuba diver as a hobby. And so when I left the military, I wanted to pursue that dream of diving around the world in different locations. Back then, before the internet, it was all magazine ads. So I would wait for the monthly diving magazine and look at all these amazing pictures. And then the documentaries started coming out, like Jacques Cousteau and National Geographic and all the classics. And that sort of fueled my interest to go and see all these unique underwater environments. And I went to Asia and Australia and the Caribbean and Central America, working my way as a diving instructor to be able to visit and travel all these locations. Until I arrived in a very unique place in the country of Costa Rica, an island called Cocos. And that sort of changed my entire career. That was around the year 2001 when I found Cocos.
Tell me about Submerge.
Submerge came together as a company about 4 years ago, based on a group of professionals that have dealing with the deep oceans, many different aspects, including submersibles, manned submersibles, for, I would say, approximately 20 years. So the knowledge that Submerge brings is a very wide, very unique skill set of many years in an industry that is only really now becoming known to the general public. But Submerge brings a lot of past experience into this emerging industry, put it this way. So we handle everything from deep ocean floor mapping to remote operated vehicles, ROVs, and rescue capabilities, manned submersibles, piloting, operations. We handle vessel requirements and vessel customization in order to deal with submersibles. And overall, I think the most important factor that Submerge brings into the industry is really experience creation, because we'll talk about it more in detail, but the end game of having a submersible is to be able to go to where no man has gone before. It's not a cliche, it's real. And that is the experience. Where do I go? What am I going to see when I go there? How am I going to see it? I want to find these unique, never seen before species and wildlife and behavior of different sea creatures. That is the objective. But to get there, there is a lot of work that has to happen for the moment that a submersible owner sits submersible and can say, wow, I just documented a new species on this planet. Okay, so that's really what Submerge is all about.
When you say submersible, the first thing that pops into people's minds that never did before 2023 is the accident that occurred this summer that made headlines around the world. So now I think in the general population, in their heads, what they think is that it's dangerous. Can you address that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's no doubt it is a complex topic, but I'm very actually pleased to have an opportunity, not because of the situation that led us to have this opportunity, but because it is a must to discuss what happened with the Titan and also show the difference between what happened with the Titan as opposed to what we do, okay? What the submersible or deep submersible industry is and has been doing for at least 50 years, okay? The first thing that comes to mind is that we need to understand that the Titan is a one-off extreme example of submersible diving. It is not in any way the mainstream or the historical submersible diving, okay? And why? Because the manufacturers of the Titan, Ocean Gate, they chose a path that was known as an opposition to everything else that had been done before or is being doing now in the submersible world. And what do I mean? The deep ocean, on the one hand, we know very little about it, but at the same time, in 1960, humans already went down to the deepest point in the ocean, the Marianas Trench, in 1960, and came back. What does that tell us? Tell us two things. One, the physics of the deep ocean are known and have not changed and cannot be changed. We cannot change the laws of pressure in the deep. It's a known fact since we've been down there in 1960. So there's no question marks as to what is the environment at 1,000 meters or 6,000 meters or 11,000. So we know that. It's very clear. What has human evolution done? Engineered solutions to be able to withstand and visit this extreme environment. So the laws of physics, we know them. We need to engineer solutions. That's what humans can do, right? How do I cope with, for example, cold, pressure, oxygen, and currents? All of those are known physical laws that engineers try to solve in order for us as humans to be able to go to these extreme environments and come back, okay? And that has also been done for the last 50, 60, 70 years. Engineers are all constantly finding solutions how to go down to these depths safely and come back. And over those decades, procedures and certifications and testing methods also have been developed. So that we know if we're going to come up with an engineering solution to take us down to 4,000 meters, how do we test it before we go down to 4,000 meters? So that obviously we come back. And OceanGate decided to take a separate path that was never taken before and say, we have an engineering solution and we have our testing methods and they don't comply with anything that has been done for the last 15 years. Why? Because we believe that's how innovation is done. That's the mindset. That's the engineering mindset that they took. Okay. And it was an experiment. It was an experiment. And it failed. Tragedy. But that's what it is. So if you compare it to a known testing procedure, a known classification procedure, a known engineering procedure that works and has zero failure over 50, 60 years, you can understand that this is a very one-off unique case and does not represent the system. Okay? That's, in my terms, the way I explain what happened with it. Okay? It was just an engineering experiment that decided to go against all the known standards and regulations and fail.
Do you think the fact that this made media headlines the world over, that it damaged possibly the reputation of the submersible market and possibly the movement forward brought it back a few years?
I think that answer has, that question has two answers. On the one hand, I say yes, for sure. The general public, because let's be realistic, very few people ever have been in submersible statistically out of the general population. So if we now suddenly take that very small percentage that have been in submersibles successfully and safely and come back, and we now try to talk about it to the entire population of the world. Yes, of course. If you don't know and the only thing you know is disaster, yeah, your natural instinct is going to say, okay, that's a disaster. But that's exactly why we're here. And that's exactly what we do. Our job, our mission, our responsibility is to say, listen, that's not an example, actually. Actually, here, look at this. We've been doing this. I've been a sub pilot for 20 years. I've taken thousands of people to the depths of the ocean. Here I am. And I keep on doing it. And I'm going to keep on doing it with more and more people and more submersibles. And so I don't see how this represents what I do. It's an unfortunate mix. It's a unique situation. It's the airline industry. Okay. Yes, Boeing had a horrible tragedy where two of their new aircrafts crashed and everybody on board perished. But people stopped flying. Did Boeing stop making aircrafts? No. They figured out what the issue here. But here we're even in a more unique situation where we know as a fact that the Titan was not built to any known classifications.
Well, I think it does also come down to human error, because even those Boeing aircraft, that was human error and that was proven
Correct.
In court. So
Correct.
When you talk about the sub accident in the summer, it's the same issue, human error.
It's human error. Now, what is our responsibility as an industry? Yes, for sure, to clean up that image that was clean until that event and now has been tarnished for that reason. And our job is to say, no, listen, this is the difference. Let me explain. And that's what professionals do. They bring fact and they bring experience and say, this is why this has nothing to do with the submersibles that are operating and have been operating. Okay.
One of the things I noticed about your company as well is that you highlight the fact that you are a company that specializes in rescue as well.
Correct. So to speak about the rescue scenario, we need to understand, first of all, what is a submersible operation? What is a submersible? And then we can understand why there needs to be a rescue factor in place that hopefully will never have to be used. That's what it is all about. So submersibles are designed to be independent, autonomous, redundant, and be capable to come back up to the surface on their own. That's the way they're designed, and I'm not going to go into very detailed engineering unless you ask me to.
No.
Why and how, okay, how systems and how the engineering is built so that there never has to be a risk, okay? That's where we start the entire process, is that there should be no risk. But because we realize the risk in what we're doing based on our experience of decades of doing it, we say, okay, here are all the risks possible. Okay, these are all the things that can happen before we go diving, so that we have all the solutions to, if they happen when we're diving, we know what to do. That's basically risk assessment, right? That's what safety and rescue is about. So I want to have someone like us that knows all the possible risks that can happen. To look at my sub, look at my yacht, look at my location. So I want someone like my company to be able to look at all the possible risks, looking at what yacht am I using? What's my support vessel? Where am I diving? Okay, what type of a submersible do I have? How deep am I going? One thing is to dive in Capri, and the other thing to dive in a remote atoll, the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Okay, there's very different factors involved. One thing is to dive from a mega yacht, and one thing is to dive from a support platform designed and dedicated to submersibles, right? So all of these factors come into the risk assessment. One thing is to dive with a crew that also handles the yacht deck and yacht bridge cleaning and yacht maintenance, and maybe see the submersible in operation twice a year. Another thing is to use the submersible with a crew. That's what it does. It uses submersibles all the time, right? So all of these, and it's a very long list of factors, they come into play. And so when we build a rescue scenario, when we design our rescue procedures, we take into account all of that, right? And we always want to work just below our limits. We don't want to reach our limits, but we definitely don't want to pass them. For example, one of the rescue training scenarios that Submerge develops with the crew is to say, okay, what happens now if the owner of the submersible and the pilot and his guests are in the sub and they're diving in the Sea of Cortez, Mexico, and they're on a seamount, and suddenly there's a change in the current and the submersible gets caught in an old fishing net that's on the bottom. Okay? What do we do? Submersible can't come up on its own because it's now lodged in some old fishing net. And it's at 100 meters or 200 meters or 300 meters, right? So what we would do in that case is we have our support vessel. It might be the mega yacht itself, the mothership. It might be a support vessel dedicated to the submersible. And we have an ROV, we have a robot, right? And that robot has tools. It has manipulator arms, has a capability to work underwater at that depth, because it's always going to be designed to work at least at the maximum depth of the submersible. Normally we even go and we add an extra safety factor and it's designed to work deeper. And now we have an experienced pilot, an ROV pilot, an operator on the yacht that says, okay, guys, this is the location. Captain, please hold me above this location. And we send in the ROV. First of all, we make an analysis, a video analysis. Okay, what's going on? Everybody's okay, is there. We have communication with the pilot and with the passengers. And all we have to do in this case is to cut the net, for instance. That could be one option. Or maybe we have a failure that's double failure. Maybe now he's caught, but also he lost his thruster power and he can't maneuver out. Okay, so in that case, we have another solution. We send that robot with a line and a hook that is connected to the mothership's winch. Okay, So we have the capability to hook and wish back up. And it goes on and on. The more experience you have, the more you can foresee all the possible events and then design solutions. So that's a little bit of an example of how that works.
One of the things that I've noticed is that more and more of these yachts are mega yachts. They're getting bigger and bigger. And one of the toys, as it were, that is becoming more popular is a submersible.
Sure.
Now, do they specifically need a captain that is trained in running that submersible? And are you seeing a trend in these yachts to train their crew for these rescues, if indeed there needs to be one? Or are they just forgoing that entirely?
Okay, so first of all, to be able to operate a submersible, you must have a certified submersible pilot.
Okay.
That's the basic requirement. And that's something that normally comes with the manufacturer's sales package. So if you buy a submersible from a manufacturer, normally that would include a basic pilot certification, right? Why? And I'll go a little bit more into detail, because the manufacturers that sell submersibles today to the super yachts are classed and certified manufacturers. That means that their vessels are registered and classed by a third party, for example, the American Bureau of Shipping or a DNV or Lloyd's Registry. So there's a third party that says, okay, first of all, show me everything that has to do with your submersible, but also show me your pilot training curriculum. How do you train pilots?
And I would assume that also has to do with insurance too.
Yes, correct. Yes. Correct. Exactly. Yes. So up to there, the procedures work. And now an owner will have a submersible and based on their choice might decide to train their deck crew or might decide to bring in like a helicopter, basically. I mean, you're not training deckhands to fly helicopters on mega yachts, but you could. So it's up to the owner, really, who he wants to be his pilot, okay? What I've seen mostly is that the industry is still half in the sense where, is this a toy, therefore my deck crew can operate it? Or is this an advanced professional asset that needs an experienced team to operate it? It's somewhere in the middle at the moment, okay? I think, and this is a subject that we can go into deeper, obviously the manufacturers want to sell a submersible and therefore they do the best job to make it feasible for a yacht to operate their submersible in the best fashion, okay? Now,
it's like anything.
When you get your driver's license, you're a driver, right? But are you an F1 driver? Obviously not. A driver.
I thought I was an F1 driver the minute I got on the Saxon.
Exactly. So an F1 driver and an 18-year-old both technically are considered legal drivers. Okay? So that's where it is. How experienced is your pilot? How many years does he have of different ocean conditions and different operational conditions? And the difference is he just got certified by the manufacturer and he's a brand new sub-pilot. Two, he has hundreds and hundreds of hours all around the oceans of the world in different conditions and in different scenarios. That's where the game is. Because the industry is still young in that sense, you don't have a lot of very experienced submersible pilot, and you don't have a lot of yachts yet really going to remote extreme ocean destinations. So there is a bit of a balance at the moment in that sense. Most pilots that will be newly certified can take their guest, their owner, to the Bahamas, to the Med, to locations where they're still going to have really good sub dives, but they're manageable. They're controlled environments, and the in-house yacht crew can handle them.
But if they're not trained in rescue...
Yes, correct.
What happens if there is an accident because the captain isn't experienced? Because that increases the potential. That's where it gets me, is that you've got an inexperienced pilot, or captain, sorry, taking it down. You haven't bothered to train any of the deck crew on rescue. What happens as a result of an accident down below? Your crew have no idea what to do at that stage.
Yes, that's true. And that's where companies like Submerge are trying to educate and come in and say, listen, it's okay if you don't want to have a full-time professional sub-rescue team on your crew list, living on board, 100% understood. But there's a lot of things we can do to train, teach, write manuals, do scenarios and drills, and also be on standby in specific times if it's a specific owner trip or a guest trip. So there are solutions. And yes, it's I think now just starting to hopefully sink in to the minds of the yacht captains, the yacht management companies, hopefully also the submersible owners themselves, is to say, wait, where's my rescue solution? And when was it last time drilled with the crew? And wait, but the crew that did it last time, they're all gone now. They're on another ship because we know that deckhands rotate between vessels. So actually right now, all the deckhands that did the rescue drill, they're not even on the ship anymore. So when was the last time this crew was trained in a rescue scenario for the submersible? That's exactly where we are. That's exactly where we come in, and you hit the nail on the head on that one.
One of the aftershocks of this accident this summer was, after emotions died down a little bit, was mainstream media then started asking, because this rescue effort took days. It cost millions upon millions of dollars, euros, whatever. So in the case of something like this, if you haven't trained the deck crew and you've got a rescue, you are calling in Coast Guard. You are calling in public funding in order to rescue, because you as a yacht owner or you as a yacht charter, you accepted the risk going underwater in a submersible with a green captain, as it were, with no rescue. This becomes an issue because it's not the taxpayer's responsibility to pay for a rescue of some multi-billionaire that decided to save maybe 20,000 euros or whatever of properly training crew when he's got a billion, multi-billion dollar vessel. This is something that has to be addressed. Do you think that in the future, there may be a requirement when a company sells a submersible to a yacht or to a super yacht, that not only should they provide that certification for a captain, but they should also provide the certification, or require at the very least the certification for rescue?
Yes, absolutely. So there's various layers to that point. First of all, the manufacturer is not necessarily the person, I would say, in charge of or to be in charge of enforcing that you have a rescue operation in place. I don't think that's the manufacturer's place. I think, you buy a car, the manufacturer doesn't sell you tow and tire changing service. They sell you the car works, you know how to drive it, it has a jack, you change the wheel, but they're not going to change the wheel for you. So I don't necessarily think the manufacturers are the...
But at the same time, if you go to a car lot and you purchase a car, the dealer is required to ensure that you have a license.
Yes,
and insurance before they can let you drive that off the lot. So
yes,
would that or should that not apply in this situation?
It should, but I just think, yes, it should. But I think it needs to come from the second and third layers in the process, which are the insurance companies that ensure the yacht and the submersible.
I think, right.
that definitely needs to be something that they need to address. It needs to be a requirement from the insurance companies. Okay, if I'm insuring you, what happens if you have an issue? Is part of the insurance? Is not part of the insurance? Can you show me that you can actually rescue, self-rescue if you need to, and then I can cover that those costs? For example, I also think that the flag states and the class certification agencies also, right? So if I'm a Cayman Island vessel or a Marshall Island vessel, and I'm being surveyed by my flag, and my flag knows I have a submersible on board, and there's regulations for that submersible under the flag, part of that needs to be the rescue plan. Sure. Okay. So, Captain, tell me, how do you rescue yourself if it's entangled at the bottom? Okay. So that I think that those are probably the two main players that would need to step up in that scenario and say, okay, great. You have the sub, you bought it from the manufacturer, you have a certified pilot that went through a certified curriculum. Fantastic. But now show me your operation, right? Now show me that you can dive it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean or wherever you're going to dive it, and you can rescue it if it has an issue. And I don't necessarily think that what the manufacturer does already, what it does, which is provide the recommendations for types of rescue. But I don't think they need to be the ones that enforce the rescue.
More of an insurance issue then.
Yeah, insurance and flag. And then you have the last layer, which personally I hope doesn't get involved, but we're probably, and those are governments, right? Assuming you're diving in territorial waters, but based on my experience diving all around the world in various countries, most of them I don't want to have a government official asking me what my rescue plan is because they don't know any.
And in all honesty, it won't matter to them unless there's a buck to be made.
Exactly. So it's either a cover your ass situation, which is even worse because it has no sense whatsoever. It's just a cover your ass situation, so I would prefer a professional body to say, okay, does this vessel have a rescue plan and rescue capability in case of one to be. Going back to the Titan and the rescue that happened on the Titan. So first of all, it was in international waters. Mm-hmm. So there's no government that was technically responsible for that rescue. And I think, and maybe this is an angle that I have personally from my military years, but and putting this aside, the taxpayer money and the bills and everything, for a Navy to be able to actually train on a scenario like the Titan is probably the best thing they could ever ask, because they would never have the opportunity and to train in a scenario like this. And it's a very narrow angle of thought, I get it. But from my point of view, I don't think the U.S. Coast Guard or the Canadian Coast Guard or the British Coast Guard and the Navies saw it as a headache or as a expense in their budget. I think they actually saw it as, okay, guys, this is the first time ever we're going to take all of our training, all of our development of all of these assets that we have in the Navy and actually put them to work on something real. You know what I mean? But yes, that was one off.
Personally, I would say that any person that is involved in Coast Guards, in rescues like this, the reason they are where they are is not out of desire to line their pockets. They are there to serve. They are there to protect. And their whole mission in life is to perform these rescues. So it has nothing to do with them. They are the first to put their lives on the line for anyone in any situation, anywhere in the world.
No, but I agree with you that in X years' time, if we have 100 super yachts with 100 billionaires, with 100 submersibles going up and down around the world in remote locations without any proper rescue, then yes, then we have an issue. Because if every second day, second week, there's, oh, my submarine got stuck, can you come and rescue me? Yes, I get that. That should not come out of public pockets, for sure. If you're doing something this unique and this extreme, you should have the capabilities and they exist to self self-raising yourself. I agree with that.
And obviously there are companies out there that offer the service of teaching your debt crew, such as Sumerge. Exactly. So there is no excuse either.
Exactly.
We see that there's a handful of multi-billionaires that are heading off into space. And you did mention earlier that we have been even really, truly discovered what we have on our own planet. It just happens to be going the opposite way, down instead of up. Is this something that will become more of a norm for a certain echelon of people, for sure, in the future?
I hope so. First of all, I very much hope, and actually not from a business point of view, but really as someone that has personally lived under the water for more than half of my life and know what a magical place it is, that would be my first hope, is that more people really have the opportunity to live or spend some time under them. That's really the first one. And yes, these private submersibles make it much more possible. When I started in the submersible world, it was either you have to be a scientist working for a scientific institute or a governmental institute, or you were in the military and had special military abilities. But other than that, no one could really just wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'd like to go down to 1,000 feet and see the fish that live down there and be able to do it. So I'd hope not. I add the next point to it where it's beyond the hope. We have to. Because why do we have to? Because we are destroying the ocean as a race, as a species, as humans. We are destroying, okay? And the only way we might stop destroying it is if we fall in love with it. And the only way we're going to fall in love with it is if we know it. And the only way we can know it is if we go visit it. So because of your childhood, you go into the forest and you fall in love with the forest, you're probably not going to want to burn it down because you've been there and you know how mad it is. So the ocean is the same thing. We, majority of us, see the ocean as the beach, as the surface. We know it only if we're on a boat or we're on the beach. We actually put our head down, and if we didn't go down to the dead ceiling. So I really believe that we need to have more people. And I have many examples of clients, guests, people that I've taken down in a submersible to deep dives. And it changed their lives because they, first of all, saw a magical planet, looks like another world. Second, definitely in the last years, they saw damage. They saw coral bleaching, and they saw algae growth killing ecosystems, and they saw plastics and metals and just rubbish sitting on the ocean floor. And it connects, right? It connects. Okay, wait a second. I was expecting everything to be Jacques Cousteau colors and the magical world, but actually I feel like I'm diving in a landfill. So what's going on here? The fishing nets, the fishing lines, the fishing equipment, the cables, the wrecks, the platforms, all of that, you can only really understand if you go underwater. And I can hope that the more people that go there, and especially if they're also heads of the industries that create this damage and have the budgets to own submersibles and actually use them and actually go down there and say, whoa, wait a second. I own that plastic water bottle company. So what are my plastic water bottles doing while sitting down here at 600 meters? And the seahorses think they're the home, and they go inside the plastic water bottle and they can't come out. So maybe I shouldn't be manufacturing plastic water bottles, for example.
I think one of the things that people don't understand as well is that the ocean is literally our filter for carbon, for oxygen, really. And if that ceases to exist,
it is our lungs, no doubt. It is our lungs, 100%, and our liver, 100%. That's exactly what it is. And so it's not just the beach and the boat trip to go out and fish. It's really much more. that. And the only way you understand that is if you go deep and you see it from inside. You remember that, what was that movie back, way back when they go in a small spaceship into the human body? It was a very famous movie. So it's something like that.
Kevin Spacey. I think Kevin Spacey.
Yes. When there's brown getting low.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yes, something like that. Exactly. And then they went inside the human body.
Yeah.
Spaceship. So
but I think Dora the Explorer did that as well. I think we're dating ourselves now. Oh, my goodness. And I read an article, and I'm not sure how long ago it was, not too much long ago, but there was a gentleman that was trying to break the world record for living under the sea. Now, do you think in the future that is something that is possible, is that we can have homes underneath the sea that are environmentally friendly, that, you know, are, I don't know. Is that a possibility?
Yes, I actually think it is a possibility. Like you said, it has been done in small, those small examples, but it has been done. And I think, it's like you said, as long as we really find a way, but it's also true for the houses we build on land, as long as we find a way to coexist with the ecosystem that we're living in and be part of it and not only consume from it, then yes, why not? Maybe that's why I'll retire in a home beneath the sea.
I can tell you one thing. I've spent a lot of time in and out of the water. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about not only the beauty under the surface, but the silence and the absolute peace, you can't find that anywhere else. There is an absolute peacefulness that comes over you underneath the water.
That is correct. That is correct. And the feeling that adds to that is the true immersion in that ecosystem. Like, even if you go hiking in high mountains, which are silent and beautiful, being under the water is the only environment that you are 360 really immersed in. And that has a very special feeling. It has a very special feeling. It's because water is so dense and you are part of something that's very dense. And then the life, the quantities of life that are moving around you when you're underwater is almost, it's like being in a city with all the people and the cars and the traffic, but yeah, fish and sea life. So it's a three-dimensional, even more maybe, experience. And the silence helps because there's nothing that, you know, is interfering with your experience. You can really immerse yourself in that. And in the submarines, in the submersibles, I think, yes, it's a human engineering solution because not all of us can hold our breath and not all of us can just go underwater with our bodies. We're not designed, not created to be able to do that. And the submersibles are really that sort of vessel and they're electric, right? And they don't use fuels and heavy oils and things like that. And so they don't emit too much negative into the ecosystem what they're going into. So I think they're the best solution we have to date to visit the ocean.
You know what? I could spend hours talking to you about this to be honest, because it is absolutely fascinating. And I hope one day that I have the opportunity to go down in a sub and experience
that. I wish that for you as well.
I want to thank you ever so much for your time, Offer. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. And thank you so much for inviting me to speak about a subject that obviously is my life and my passion. So thank you.
You've been listening to Offer Ketter. He is the president of Submer. We will make sure to provide all the links for Submerge underneath this interview for you when it airs, if you're interested in getting in touch and possibly training your deck crew on how to rescue your submersible. You've been watching another edition of Yacht Crew Vlogs right here on Yachting International Radio. My name is Rhea. I have been your host. We'll see you again next time.